So it's a pleasure to contribute as a chair to this distinguished panel. And before I introduce to you our two speakers, the last two speakers of the conference, I would like to give a few introductory remarks about normative power and Europe and the future of the EU diplomatic system. So let me first remind you that the Lisbon Treaty mandated the European Union to promote its values and champion an international order which is based on the respect of international law, human rights, the principle of equality, solidarity, eradication of poverty, and fair trade. The EU's normative external action and transformative power, and in particular its contribution to peace building, can be witnessed in a very diverse toolbox of policy instruments. First of all, the security, rule of law, and public administration related interventions which are carried out under the security and defense policy, as well as many policies such as the neighborhood policy or enlargement policy. Secondly, the EU engages in policy dialogue, both with partner governments as well as organizations and actors inside and outside the region. The EU also offers economic incentives, such as closer cooperation, preferential access to the EU internal market, and support for loans and investments. And importantly, the EU grants development assistance provided through budget lines for technical assistance and aid for humanitarian and development purposes. Let me also remind you that, as we heard many times during these 1.5 days, the EAS, the External Action Service, was established with the ambition to develop an integrated, coherent, consistent, and coordinated foreign policy, one that is also able to promote this value-driven external policy and foreign policy, which is mandated by the treaty. Just to mention a few of the latest developments, the EU has designed a human rights framework for its external actions. It also sent a special representative on human rights. And it has designed sort of a holistic approach to its civilian peace-building and civilian management missions. So against the backdrop of this normative, value-driven mandate and mission for the European Union in its external actions, the question arises, what is the EU diplomatic system for, and how shall it carry out this normative purpose? Should it be the traditional soft power mission that the EU has conducted so successfully and traditionally, for example, under the enlargement policy? Or should it go beyond that and then maybe take it to the next level of interest representation, a different toolbox and different policy instruments? So what would be the nature of the diplomatic system against the backdrop of this normative mission and normative mandate? Secondly, another very important point here is the institutional arrangements. Much has been said about how the European Commission seemed to guard its competences, its powers. The question here is that in the future, how should the demarcation of competences take place? What should be a reasonable allocation of powers so as to promote the values that the European Union is mandated to represent externally? So our two speakers are going to address these and other issues in their presentations. First, I will give the floor to Mr. Dan Smith. He is the Secretary General of International Alert, and he has a very significant experience in peace-building issues as a chairman of the UN Peace-Building Fund's advisory group and also as director of the International Peace Research and Institute. Mr. Smith, the floor is yours.
Oops. Sorry. Just get this straight. I think it's going to need to be at top volume for me because I'm in the late stages of a cold, and so I have almost no voice at all. Please, somebody at the back, if my voice does drift away, do please kind of make some sort of gesture like this, which I will assume means raise your volume and doesn't mean stand up and get out of here. Congratulations to all of you for hanging around for this long. I always admire stamina. It's a great quality. Well done. I hope to reward you for your stamina with some brief remarks upon the theme of what on earth is the EEAS for. The first question I think to ask is, why are we talking about normative power? I think Tamara really usefully outlined some of the issues and the points there. I mean, to me, first of all, it's normative power because the EU is not a state. Secondly, it's normative because this is an area of extraordinary comparative advantage for the EU compared to many other actors in the international arena. And thirdly, because there are openings for normative power which are not being fully exploited or used at the moment. So there is a niche awaiting there. But why the EEAS? And I want to leave to one side, as simply not bothering me for a moment, the clause in the treaty which says it's needed because it's there to support the High Representative. I cannot think of a stupider reason for setting up a large institution than that it's there to support one individual. One individual might be there in order to lead a large institution, but for heaven's sakes, there are better purposes for institutions. Now, I think there are different arguments which have been advanced for why the EEAS, and I want to look at just a couple of them and sort of peel away a few onion skins of argument and see if I can find something worthwhile that's left. One argument, I think, is because the EU needs a body to coordinate its external face, its actions, in and to the world. Well, okay, but as an argument, I think that it hurdles over a number of facts and logical or sub-arguments that are really its logical foundations and its premises. You need to be taking an awful lot for granted about your attitude to the EU in order to argue that the EEAS is a good thing because it puts an external face on the EU. And because of that, I think it's an argument which, while it appeals a lot to, let's say, EU supporters, or however we want to word that, it doesn't have a great deal of political bite. Under Chatham House rules, there was a seminar yesterday convened with David's help, I think, by the House of Lords subcommittee on the EEAS. And this was one of the questions which was being raised. You know, why doesn't the EEAS do better in achieving buy-in, in promoting itself, in projecting itself abroad? And I think that one of the reasons is because one of the main arguments used in favor of it lacks political bite. It's an argument that takes too much for granted. I think if you took that argument seriously and were persuaded by it, it would support a quite considerable international presence, delegations in 140 countries, the number of people needed for each delegation, that would be pretty large employment. You'd need an administrative centre back in Brussels to coordinate it, but I don't think you're talking about very much to do with policy, with foreign policy as such, because your argument is about coordinating the external face and actions of the EU. It's not actually an argument about making the EU into an international actor. That's a different argument. So it's not an argument, by the way, that heads you in the direction, necessarily, of an EU foreign ministry. Okay, let's move on to a different argument. Provisionally, let's say, it's not because we take the EU for granted and want an external face on it. But provisionally, it's because there are things that need to be done, which are not done or are not done well enough by other institutions that already exist, including institutions within the EU, but including also national foreign ministries and so on. So what are those things? Well, again, let's revert quickly to the treaty, as Tamara reminded us. One of these things, a major one of these things, could be promoting values. The next word I have written in my notes here says, "Humph." I am skeptical about a foreign policy which is entirely based on the idea of promoting values. such values as we see in European politics and economy, right? Don't get me started on how much cheap ammunition, how many cheap points can be scored by Eurosceptics in this country and around the world, anybody who wants to disagree with any component of EU policy. You know, a large area such as that covered by the member states of the European Union contains all manner of different kinds of behavior by governments, by institutions, by companies. It includes corruption, it includes parliamentary expenses scandals. The more that the EU emphasizes itself as a promoter of good values, the more ammunition is just being handed to President Ahmadinejad or who else can I think of, the late Meles, leader of Ethiopia, Rajapaksa in Sri Lanka, anybody who wants to score some kind of cheap point at the expense of those values which we do actually hold dear. But okay, if that is what we want for the EEAS, if that is to be its purpose, get yourself a good PR mechanism. You'd need lots of presence in other countries, 140 delegations, it's a lot of people, but you wouldn't need very much by way of policy. You'd need coordination and the promotion of new PR materials or the preparation of new PR materials back in Brussels. But again, strangely, it seems to me, this argument for the EEAS doesn't necessarily lead you in the direction of something that you might call an EU foreign ministry, a body which does policy, which does action in the world. So can I take a second stab at what those things could be? And I start by thinking about the world today. This is a world of unprecedented problems and issues. We have never been here before. 200 years ago, the world population passed the 1 billion mark. It is now standing at 7 billion. 200 years ago, the world urbanized population was 30 million people, 3% of the total world population at the time. By the way, just coincidentally, 30 million is approximately the number of people who emigrated from Europe to the USA in the great period of immigration into the US in the latter part of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. The urban population today is 50% of the world population. It's 3.5 billion people. It has grown since 1990 by 1.2 billion people. It's currently growing at 100 million people a year, or a little bit more than that. Right? Think about some of the cities where people are living. Think about Shanghai. We're all enormously dependent upon Shanghai, much more than we like. That's a city which is literally sinking under its own weight. It's also built in a typhoon area and on a delta floodplain. Think about climate change. The vision of a world in which there's 2 degrees warming compared to pre-industrial times is a fading dream. We are currently 1.6 degrees centigrade warmer than the average in the half century leading up to 1950. And that, is, by the way, is the finding of a leading climate skeptic in the US who was given a massive grant by a climate skeptic foundation to prove that climate change and global warming were not happening. And when he examined the evidence on an unprecedentedly large scale, he concluded that, yes, indeed it is. But climate change isn't the only one of the planetary boundaries which we are in danger of transgressing or have already transgressed. We do not know what will happen when all of these different environmental issues, loss of biodiversity, pollution in the atmosphere, coral bleaching, loss of ozone, the dead zones appearing in the world's oceans and lakes, we do not know what will happen when all these interact. We're entering a zone of uncertainty, a zone outside, beyond the planetary boundaries. We've seen already, I think, in various places, the way in which these kinds of pressures and also pandemics, health issues also, impact upon long-range security questions and upon the long-term prospects of living in a peaceful and stable country or peaceful and stable region or world. Developing much better and stronger long-range peace-building capacities and a capacity to support resilient development strategies, which development, that is to say, which is resilient in the face of these environmental pressures and demographic pressures, which have built and are building and will continue to build. This seems to me to be something for an EEAS to focus on. This seems to me to be something about which not much is being done. If you are discussing these issues in the UK, in London, you're sitting in a former imperial capital where there is, which is the headquarters of a large and capable foreign service. You're not sitting in the capital of, excuse me, everybody who's in this room, I'm not saying the next few words in an insulting way. You're not sitting in the capital of Estonia or Latvia or Slovenia. I did say that one. You're not even sitting in the capital of Oslo or Stockholm. Right? And Scandinavian countries also have difficulty having the capacity in their foreign ministries and the elsewhere within their government institution to take on these big issues. But actually, in London also, and in Berlin, and in Paris, it is hard to take on the full dimensions of these issues. They demand responses which the diplomatic tradition is not used to producing. They demand, these are problems that cannot be resolved through dispute, confrontation, and negotiation, which is what you see trying to happen in the climate change negotiations, for example. These are problems which have to be resolved by dialogue and cooperation. It's not actually about promoting interest, except in a very global and general sense. It's about promoting solutions to problems. This, I think, is where the EEAS should focus. But again, and for the third time, I'll repeat, this doesn't seem to me to be an argument that leads towards thinking of a new EU Ministry of Foreign Affairs. But it does seem to me to be an argument that leads towards thinking about the EU as a major actor in international affairs, a major normative actor using primarily soft power to do with persuasion, knowledge, representation, and problem solving. And it seems to me to be an opportunity which has not yet been missed in the formation of the EEAS. When you work in peace building, as I do, you are an eternal optimist. I'll end there.
July, he was a colleague of mine at the Osser Institute, and then he moved to the Center for the European Policy Studies in Brussels, a think tank. He's one of the founders of CLEAR, a Center for the Law of EU External Relations, together with Ramses Wessel, and is still on the governing board of the center. You can find Stephen's paper that he wrote for Oxfam, and also a longer version that was published in the CLEAR Working Paper Series on the conference website. And he really has an insight in the EU's normative power and norm diffusion.
Thanks very much, Tamara, for those kind words. The danger of filling the graveyard slot, David, is normally that there's no one left to talk to. But that's certainly not the case. I'm happy about that. Or the other danger is that you end up saying much of the same things that have already been said. Dan Smith is shown that that's also not the case. So that's testimony to your idea of organizing this conference at a very timely moment, I think. What I will try and do is perhaps sweep up a few points and frame them in what are perhaps a set of recommendations for strengthening the European External Action Service with a view to the 2013 review of the service. And let me start off first on a few substantive issues without referring to or borrowing analogies of the animal kingdom. We've had a lot of talk on what is the EES for, which really boiled down to what is the EU's position in the world And how should that inform the organization and the functioning of the EES as such? Shopping lists, laundry lists of priorities have been mentioned. The mainframe of the European strategy, which dates back to 2003, has a very security-oriented slant to it. Luckily, there is now a revision process taking place already, and that goes more or less in parallel, should at least end up more or less in parallel with the review of the EES itself. It's a think tank-driven process to, on the invitation, by the way, of four member states, Sweden, Spain, Poland, and Italy, in order to revise that 2003 ESS and come up with a European global strategy which reflects the position of the European Union in the world, which is indeed changed very much, Dan. So that would be an encouraging sign, perhaps, and moving along in this process should perhaps inform also the review of the organization and the functioning of the EES. Tamara started out by quoting elements from Article 21 of the Treaty on the European Union, which indeed provides a very cosmopolitan worldview for the European Union, a worldview perhaps of days gone by, where indeed normative power was being exerted, willingly accepted by especially countries in the neighborhood. But even that soft power has waned as the economic and financial crisis has kicked in. And looking from the perspective of applicant countries, it seems that the image of this latter-day El Dorado or subsidy union has indeed faded to quite a considerable extent. So it's also to create a sense of pre-accession fatigue, not just enlargement fatigue on the member state side. There is a sense of pre-accession fatigue with the European Union as well among applicant countries. And this is something to keep in mind. Essentially, the gap between that constitutional obligation resting upon the European Union and its institutions to roll out its own values, which have inspired its creation and enlargement, and the reality on the ground, looking at the position of the European Union at this moment in time. Perhaps one nuance to what Dan has said on the strategy of the European Union solely being premised, at least that's how I understood it, Dan, correct me if I'm wrong, solely being premised on norm export. This is not entirely true. The complement to Article 21 of the Treaty on the European Union is Article 3, Paragraph 5 of the EU Treaty, which in more general terms sets out the external action objectives for the European Union. And there it says that the European Union shall strive to protect also its interests and the interests of its citizens abroad. And that's very much part and parcel of the mandate the European Union has been given by the Lisbon Treaty in EU external action. Now, if on the substantive side of things it becomes clearer what the EU's position in the world is, what its priorities are in terms of protecting its own interests in the world through a European global strategy so as to update and revise the ESS of 2003, then we can see how the ES can contribute to attaining those goals. And here I was a bit puzzled by what Cesare Onestini said as he interpreted the role of the European External Action Service as a factory of ideas. Sure, but not only that, arguably. As has been shown in this conference, the Action Service is representing the European Union, next to, of course, the Commission, Article 17. It is protecting EU interests, it is negotiating, it is entering into dialogue, mediation with third states, it's reporting back to the EU and member states in that respect. And it is coloring, politically coloring, the implementation of the EU's instruments in EU external action. All in support of not only the High Representative, but as the Council decision of 2010 says in its article, Article 2, I believe, also in support of the President of the European Council, of the President of the Commission, and of the Commission as a whole. But, and here's the hitch, and I'll quote it, without prejudice to the normal tasks of the European Commission. Unquote. Article 3, paragraph 1 of the Council decision. And it's strange we haven't touched upon this at all yet in this conference. To my mind, the review in 2013 could be used as a moment to look at what exactly these normal tasks of the European Commission are, because only then will we be able to really determine issues which pertain to the principle of coherence and how to reinforce coherence in cooperation between the EES and the Commission. Which brings me to the more organizational issues and maybe some of the recommendations I have, and I'll try to be short on them so as not to sound too tedious. The European External Action Service, apart from being a factory of ideas, a negotiator, a representation, is the big coordinator interinstitutionally and with the member states. There was a picture, or a cartoon rather, published in The Economist magazine a while back when Ashton was appointed, essentially sitting in her office behind a desk full of telephones. I'm not sure whether that really depicts what is happening at this moment, but it does get across the message. Of course, the EES is more than just a switchboard. If you look at the other functions that it is pursuing, but indeed, I mean, its function is derivative to the competences which have been granted by the treaty to its masters, the High Representative, and you would have to puzzle together her tasks and competences from different provisions of the treaty in order to get a bit of a clear view what exactly she Lady Ashton now is doing, and indeed she has multiple hats. And then you would also have to collect those powers which have been granted in the realm of EU external action to the President of the European Council, to the Commission, and to the President of the Commission. And this is where I get to some of the recommendations for the 2013 review. Arguably, this review will not be able to solve all issues. Cesare Onestino already yesterday highlighted that, well, organizational matters could be addressed, and that is exactly what the phrase also says in the Council decision of 2010. So in a way, the review is limited in scope, but of course it would be a shame if not a more comprehensive review were undertaken so as to look at the overall contribution of the EES to attaining the EU's objectives and indeed its cooperation with member states, diplomatic services, European Commission and the Parliament. But there are obvious limits to the review. The idea was floated to alleviate some of the stress with the current HR/VP by appointing deputies. I think it was Robert Cooper yesterday who also highlighted that. A political deputy with the backing of the member states so as to replace her in council or foreign affairs council level. And on the commission side, also a deputy, so as to have her represented in the college meetings where, for now, this is proven to be problematic in view of her traveling schedule and also the stance taken by Barroso in accepting deputization on her part at this stage. So in that sense, that would probably require an amendment at a higher level than just that of the Council decision, but at treaty level. The second would be that some of the changes would more effectively be made once there is a new legislation of the European Parliament 2014 bringing in a new commission. I recall a point which was already made with Barroso starting his second commission. He carved up portfolios and essentially carved off a part of DG RELEX so as to prevent it from moving to the EEAS and retaining some of the visibility or competences, I'm not entirely sure, certainly visibility in the realm of the European neighborhood policy. You essentially have a deputy commissioner there, Fühle, who constantly cooperates with Lady Ashton, who has no staff whatsoever, or one or two within the commission, and for the rest, all the staff has been moved to the EES, apart from some of the political staff still in other DGs. It would be logical for the next commissioner to come in to take a bolder step and move the rest of ENP to the EES. It would probably create more coherence, and also maybe rob some of the externals, namely ENP countries in the East, from the idea, or their citizenry at least, that there is hope for future membership. If you look at the person who's also dealing with enlargement in his portfolio. Okay, reinforcing the role of the ES in promoting coherence in external action. A lot has been said about joining up the ES with DEFCO. I will not repeat it, but it's certainly an issue to keep in mind. I mentioned ENP integrating those parts, those remaining parts now within the Commission into the structures of the EES. The same has been mentioned by Onestini on crisis management issues. And perhaps, as far as the structure of the EES is concerned, you could also think about what is now still the DG on foreign policy instruments. The European Commission holds its hands on the till. It is still responsible for the operational budget and CFSP. It's not an oddity or an anomaly which should be changed, and wouldn't the review process of 2013 offer an opportunity to do that? Here also maybe, which would require probably a legal amendment to the 2010 Council decision, the separation of EES and Commission staff and EU delegations should be mitigated by strengthening the authority of the heads of delegations, that's already been mentioned, by simplifying reporting lines, but also by unifying, and this is a point not mentioned before, I think, the current split in financial circuits, and thus, again, increase coherence between political and issues of aid nature. A second big point I wanted to raise is the VP mandate, or VP part of the High Representative's mandate. That really ought to be strengthened in order to enhance coherence. It seems the VP part is not being played out all that much by Lady Ashton, and there may be reasons for it within the Commission or with the President of the European Commission. To my mind, the VP should chair the meetings of what was previously called the RELEX group within the European Commission, i.e. those commissioners in charge of external dimensions of internal policies or indeed external relations as such, trade, enlargement, humanitarian aid, even monetary affairs these days. Now, under Barroso I, this RELEX group used to meet almost every month. Under Barroso II, this has happened maybe a handful of times. This is where the VP could really join up, coordinate external relations issues within the Commission, and then join that up with the CFSP part of her job as HR. I've mentioned the point of deputization, so I won't mention it again. Maybe my final point would be cooperation with member states' diplomacies, which obviously needs to be strengthened, both at central level, but also in multilateral institutions and in bilateral postings, in the interest of cost saving, the drive for efficiency, information exchange should be further developed, regularized, procedures should be harmonized, to my mind. Infrastructure shared, sure. The potential of co-location with member states' embassies and the EU delegations examined. And in this context, and that was the point I was trying to make earlier on, perhaps not that eloquently, what has been done in the context of cooperation with between the UK and Commonwealth countries like Canada could indeed also be done in the framework of the EEAS. And I'll leave it at that.
Your structured suggestions. I would give the floor for questions. I'm sure both very critical approaches will trigger lots of questions and comments.
Okay. Sorry to be out of the loop. Could you say what BP stood for? In your last but one point about BP, what was that?
VP, the Vice President of the European Commission.
Sorry, it was VP, I missed it.
Yes.
Thanks. William Althwaite, Newcastle. I was just a question to Dan, really, that, I mean, if he's right, and I'm sure he is, about the kind of massive problems that the EU is confronting, that the world is confronting, would it not be better to not have a European External Action Service, but to strengthen the role of the Commission, the Parliament, and so forth. And, I mean, clearly there's a lot of expertise here and in Paris, Berlin, and in other European capitals in their foreign ministries. But to use them simply as a repository of knowledge would be one thing, and to confuse this with an attempt at a coordinated foreign policy seems to be a different question. I mean, I have no problems with the notion of a European foreign policy, but it would then make sense to wind up the countries, not the countries, but the foreign ministries of the countries whose flags we're looking at behind you.
Thank you very much. Some years ago, I had a problem with the House of Lords. But it wasn't the Lords themselves, it was an administrative problem within the House of Lords. And I discovered, and I think, is it Black Rod that runs the status and the things behind the scenes? And I'm wondering who it is who does a similar job. I'm going generally to say Brussels, because throughout these 2 days we've heard of staffing problems or budget problems and so on between the different departments. And the Commission's holding on to people that it ought to release to other departments and so on. But who is the person who, behind the scenes, could get to grips with this, particularly when you've got calls for budget reductions and so on? I don't think that the President of the Commission does it. They're all operating, doing what they do. Who is it behind the scenes who can do something about the staffing, the financing, and protecting the future of this thing that we all very much want to survive and prosper?
Coming back to the values, and there is a real problem, I think, was raised with the Commission issue here, because what we see in reality today is that DevCo is pursuing development goals. You have ECHO and Georgieva pursuing humanitarian goals. You have Climate Action DG pursuing climate change, the whole agenda there. And most of the Commission DGs that I've interviewed in my talks see the role of the External Action Service as security. So when you come to what Stephen talked about, the European global strategy issue, whether you need a follow-up to the European, I have argued, obviously, that it's useless to make such an effort without fully getting the Commission on board. You need to have, because we need to resolve the issue, how we square the values and interest issue in I wonder, Dan may have a view, perhaps, to say what he thinks about this debate now about the European global strategy. Is it a good idea or not? Because, frankly, what we know for the moment is that there is great skepticism about it in the three big capitals. There was a, you can see on Carl Bildt's blog that he went to a seminar in Paris yesterday on the global strategy, but only in the context of ESDP military part of it. So there in Paris there seems to be an interest in doing that. But the overall squaring of the values with interest, there we still have an open debate.
Let's take one more question by David, and we have another round.
Thank you. I mean, I have absolutely no competence to talk about security with Lars and Brian Crowe in the room. But one thing we haven't talked about, and there's no reason why we should have done, is about what national foreign policy was always about, and that was the national interest, whatever it was. I think Mike Smith mentioned it at one point and also said whatever that is. And I think what we should be concerned with if we have an emerging diplomatic system in the European Union is what the European interest would be. Now, I hear what Lars says, and that's a security side that I can't comment on. But maybe it's in our European interest to have a kind of interest which is different from other national interests have been, the kind of thing that Dan was saying, that we have a European interest which goes beyond the narrow material interests of a state and actually takes seriously the role that a power, the greatest civilian power in the world, I think one of the Secretaries General of the Commission called it, the power that an organization like that could have in a normative sense in terms of the values that Western Europe, now the whole of Europe, hold dear. But that needs some really thorough thinking, and I doubt whether it's a flyer for all the reasons that we could imagine. But I think where I was coming from in programming this session was to get people to go away thinking that if there's going to be a European diplomatic service of some kind, that it shouldn't be just a replica of national services with interests to defend, but with a different kind of interest to promulgate.
Is this working? Yeah, it looks like it is. Well, you know, big questions, and we want to have a second round of questions, so you'll forgive me for giving very sketchy answers. I think that the issues which have been raised are really fundamental ones. Maybe I'll begin with the last question with David, because that's, after all, he's the person who invited me here, so I need to be nice. Yeah, I know. But, you know. I think that I came in my remarks, I came into the same issue from the other end, in that I didn't ask first what would be an EU interest. I asked first what would be the issues and the problems that there is an absence of action on and a need to take on, a pressing need. And that was why I talked rather vividly about numbers and planetary boundaries. I think these things are pressing right now, and our institutions that we have to hand are failing right now to address them properly. And the price for that is already being paid, but will be increasingly paid. It's not too late to put it right. It's not too late to get corrective action. I'm not doomsaying. I just think something needs to be done. What needs to be done, then, would be something which expressed the European interest. Now, part of the European interest on these issues must surely express itself in sort of global, basic human terms, if you like. But there could be something else which you could also throw in, and it would be congruent with a lot of national interest, but not with all interests all the time of all member states. Right? It would cover part of the terrain, but not all of it. And that is the interest in an increasingly law-based international system. That seems to me to be something which is A, good,
right? Because the more law-based things are, then the less arbitrary power is, and in general, the better people thrive under law, in law-based systems rather than in systems where power is very arbitrary. And secondly, given that European Union member states have opted for that system, it's also something which is pragmatically in the interest not just of the EU but of the member states themselves, although there will be times, you know, just as for any individual in society, when maybe some footling law or regulation prevents you from doing exactly what you want in your back garden. Yes, but that doesn't mean that you have less of a stake in a law-based system in your country, including over the issue which you're annoyed about. So that might be one way to get towards that. I think that also speaks a little bit to your question, William, which is, wouldn't it be better to leave these things to national foreign ministries, which, after all, are already established? And I think that the reason why not is, firstly, because all of their institutional culture takes them to either package up the issues wrongly and misidentify them, or handle them wrongly once they've even got them properly identified, or simply say, you know, that's not our business. You know, that's climate change. That's environmental. You know, that's not political. That's not about foreign policy. That's not about national interest. But, of course, it's about the relationship between states, and foreign policy establishments ought to be taking it up. I think that the fact that they're not would be one part of it, or not taking it up well enough, that some national structures lack, including inside the EU, lack the capacity to be dealing with those issues adequately would be a second argument. And a third one would be, but this is also part of building an increasingly law-based international system, which we need in order to be addressing some of these issues of planetary boundaries and so on, which I raised. And then thirdly, I think that brings me to the question, you know, this neat parceling up where DEVCO does development, DG Climate Change does climate change, ECHO does humanitarian, so EEAS can do something else, right, which is none of them. I mean, this is such a bureaucratic, political, turf-based set of arguments. And one of the things which has, you know, frustrated me working in peacebuilding is when one wants to find somebody to talk to about peacebuilding, and you think that, well, you know, Eastern Congo being torn apart by violent conflict and therefore unable to develop, let's go to a development cooperation agency or ministry or DEVCO and talk about peace building and conflict in a very specific way with them. And the answer is, oh no, you know, you're talking about peace and conflict. Yeah. We do development. Peace and conflict happens down the corridor, take the elevator, get out of the building, walk down the street, over the other side, go to the other side of Brussels, and that's where you'll find people doing peace and security. Well, then in that case, mister, you're not doing development, so get out of your office immediately, because you're clearly not confronting the issues properly. And I think that consistently there have been international statements trying to reconcile and get over these divisions. Jan Eliasson likes to use the set of phrases, no peace without development, no development without peace, and none of the above without human rights. I might have mixed up his wording there, but it's the triangular relationship between those three things. You can't have one without the other. So get over your turf divisions and get working on it. And the statements have been made, the high-level panels have reported. I'm pretty confident that the current high-level panel on post-2015 international development framework will say that in order to for countries to develop, they've got to resolve basic issues of conflict and of how they are governed. Right? But getting over it institutionally has been another thing. And that's where I saw and still see the EEAS as an opportunity to get over those institutional Chinese walls. And that effort or that opportunity, of course, is, you know, it's fought against, it's resisted by those who have the institutional investment in precisely those neat, clear divisions between topics. And this will be sorted out politically. I mean, if political leaders get the idea that that this matters, it can be sorted out. There's no intrinsic reason why not. There's only the preference of bureaucrats with this tradition and this history behind them.
I'm aware of the time. I'll try to be short. On the question by the gentleman from the European Movement, who the person's lurking in the shadows? The chief operating officer would be, you know, one of the key persons to talk to within the European External Action Service. He's a Brit, by the way, David O'Sullivan, may help. And then, of course, there was his, you know, right hand here, Cesare Onestini, and and other figures within the corporate board. On the question by Lars Erik, who is leaving, bye. it would be foolish not to get the goals on board, which are spurred by different parts of the Commission apparatus. Absolutely. But what we need is a mainframe that incorporates all of them in a comprehensive European global strategy. So I see great value in such a mainframe. The current one, which is entirely premised on security, is insufficient, not comprehensive enough to deal with the EU external action mindset, culture, approach, what was it, organizational culture, that we've embedded within the treaties. And I think it should be reviewed much more often, perhaps every year, certainly every 5 years when you have a new European Parliament coming in and a new Commission coming in. We shouldn't wait for 10 years. But yes, I mean, a comprehensive one. What is the European interest, which is more than the sum of member states' interests? Question by David. I think here, perhaps the bottom line is indeed peace and prosperity in Europe, recognized by the Nobel Peace Committee in extending the prize earlier this year. And apart from that, defending European interests in trying to shape alliances, build partnerships with other countries in the world. And indeed, international organizations, for one, indeed, to strive towards a law-based multilateral system that is indeed in the interest of the European Union and may exceed that of the sum of some member states. If you look into the future, also in the economic and financial context, Basel III and the very intricate system on banking governance will be totally useless 10 years down the line when only the European Central Bank will meet with the Fed and with the Chinese National Bank. Those kind of interests simply exceed member states' interests, and certainly those in this particular example, of course, of the Eurozone countries. It's perhaps time also we bring out the flag of Europe from behind the screen at this point.
David, do we have a time for another round?
As long as people are happy not to. And I want to say a closing word, but it is just a couple of words, so I don't want you to talk to me.
Any more questions? Yes.
I'm Joan Pierce. I'm a retired commission official. I worked in three delegations, one enlargement delegation and two in the Western Balkans. And when I listened to Dan Smith talking about promoting a law-based international system, it seems to me that in some ways that mirrors the enlargement policy of the Union. That's what we were trying to do and did with a certain degree of success in at least some countries. But what we discovered was that introducing a law-based system doesn't simply entail passing the laws. It also entails ensuring that they're implemented and implemented effectively. And for that, we drew very much on member states' expertise. And we had an extensive twinning program, for instance, where we twinned ministries in the enlargement countries with counterparts in member states who were able to explain to them how you didn't just introduce a law, but actually ensured that it was implemented and effective. Now, that's also been attempted in the context of the neighbourhood policy, but without the carrot of membership at the end. So I think if the EU were to try to go down that road, it would have to think quite hard about what the carrot is that convinces countries that it's worthwhile to follow this path. Thank you.
Simon?
Thank you. I'll try and make this brief. Thank you very much, Dan, for your inspiring presentation. I just wanted to ask you, getting back to some more structural issues, what do you think is going wrong with that horrible Brussels word, mainstreaming? Because there are already attempts to mainstream human rights concerns, for instance, consistently in bilateral agreements, multilateral agreements, as you know well. But it seems that the EU often promotes double standards. If you could just go a little bit more into that, I'd be very grateful. Stephen, a chance to promote your favorite project. A lot of the suggestions you made are eminently sensible, but they may involve revisiting the Council decision of July 2010. And here, there is already some political nervousness, to say the least, about revisiting that decision on the part of the UK. We've also read speeches by David O'Sullivan, where he's also wanted to minimize interfering with the July 2010 decision. If you could just go a little bit into the political pros and cons of extensive review and maybe revision of that decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry. I should just say, first of all, that I work at the House of Lords. I don't represent anybody at the House of Lords. I'm speaking entirely personal capacity, former diplomat. Just one thing, it seems to me that one of the main interests of Europe is security, and particularly security on its borders, and there are all sorts of ways of dealing with this, but your security is sea routes for oil, all the rest of it. But if you think that is it, then presumably the missions that are sent out are extremely important, but do you need the EEAS for that?
Thank you for your questions. I'll take Simon's first, obviously, in an attempt also to plug a project in which he himself is involved. It's called EES 2.0, and it's essentially a group of legal scholars trying to write a commentary, legal commentary, to the existing Council decision, not just out of academic interest, but also in order to see whether there's enough interpretative room for interpretation so as to accommodate some of the changes that are needed to, and that's already going venturing into an answer here on political prose, on creating a more efficient diplomatic service for the European Union, a more effective one, one that can be more visible. So there's certainly some extra mileage to be gotten out of that, and that's become clear, I think, also from several interventions earlier on. The idea of the project is, you know, to see whether there's interpretive scope to accommodate those necessary changes to the organization and functioning à décision constante, without revising the Council decision as such, because indeed there's quite a bit of fear, perhaps, amongst David's, about the EES itself, that this could open a Pandora's box, having all kinds of, difficulties in renegotiating the Council decision also with the European Parliament, especially if the changes would have staffing and budget consequences, where the European Parliament has a right of veto on changing the add-on regulations to the council decision, and thus could also influence what goes into the council decision and what not. So that is obviously the negative or the con of the review, is that this becomes an endless process. However, I think that it is necessary to revise it, if only to get rid of some of the transition arrangements which are still included in the text, and so as to update the council decision. Is the EES needed to dispatch the CSDP missions, EU Blue Helmet missions? Probably it is better to incorporate indeed the crisis management bodies within the structures of the EES, as now has been done, and to link them up more firmly with the civilian side of crisis management, which is still an effort which has to be undertaken. I mean, now the crisis management bodies, especially the military ones, are set very much aside from the rest of the organizational chart. Better integration there would certainly help also in steering those missions, I think.
Thank you. Can I ask you to be
brief? Of course. I think that the last question, I fully agree with Stephen and his answer. I'm not really nearly enough of a Brussels insider to know what is going wrong with mainstreaming. What I know is that bureaucratically there are two ways to park difficult issues. One is to say that you're mainstreaming, and the other one is to set up some specialized unit for it and lose it down the far end of the corridor. When real mainstreaming happens, that's to say when concerns are truly absorbed into an institution, you can tell that is happening. There are activities that institution will need to do. The way in which staff are assessed, how performance is managed, will all be changing. And institutions generally, and indeed individual staff members, generally prefer that not to happen. People don't like that kind of change, and that's why it tends to take a long time, even when it's done very well. On the enlargement and the carrot question, indeed, when the way to promote a law-based system is essentially through a process which turns acceptance of laws into being the credit card which you put into the ATM machine in order to get out the money which is supposed to come with EU membership. I think that the problem there, although it can work, is that it is sort of debasing the currency. Countries that have developed their economies to the highest level that we've so far seen have tended to be those countries which have developed and relied upon a law-based system. And at some point in their development, an elite that held the levers of power, but held the levers of power in an arbitrary way, that's to say that if I say it's right, and if I say it's wrong, right? That elite decides over a period of time that it has its own self-interest in law, and very often that swings on property, because I cannot pass my property to my children, which I want to do, unless there is a law-based system. The second thing which it very often hangs on is business, because you and I cannot do business on a really large scale unless we can each trust the legal system within which we're operating, which gives us legally enforceable contracts and so on. And so very often the law-based system comes about sort of by the back door. And I do think that sometimes the way in which the effort is made to promote that kind of a system is rather clunking. It doesn't pay enough attention to history and to how things have actually worked. It doesn't pay enough attention to the realities in the countries where one is trying to make it work. It has worked in a considerable number of the new EU member states of the last decade. Right? It has not worked so far in some, and without that carrot of the money, it's not working in others yet, for you know, that lie outside the zone of enlargement. That doesn't mean to say that it is going to fail, and that doesn't mean to say that the EU has less of an interest in a law-based system because of those difficulties.
Thank you so much for a very insightful presentations and the great questions. I think David wants to say a few words. So.
I was going to come over there.
Yes, come.
People want to go now, that's right. I just want to say thank you for everybody for staying so long, because as you rightly say, at this time on a Friday night, you do expect a lot of people to go, and a lot of people have gone, but we still have here. This is a trick now where you've got your notes and your microphone in the same hand. But we still have half the people, and that's pretty good. So I think that's an indication of the fact that people have really enjoyed this. And I want to thank everybody, all the speakers particularly, for coming. And you are all my friends as well, so it's rather nice. It's been like a kind of day and a half's party for me, and that's been very good. I just wanted to say a couple of sensible things apart from thanking friends for coming. Part of the purpose of this was not just the European External Action Service, but the nature of diplomacy, something that Joseph and I are going to do a book on, Joseph Butterer, and something that Brian Hocking, who's not here anymore, already did a book on. I wanted this look at the European External Action Service to be seen in the framework of the changes in modern diplomacy. And I think that's been very good. We've done a lot of that, and now we need to dot the I's and cross the T's in it. One of the things that I think that we all learned, and we learned that from the session on Rwanda and the DRC, was that there is a kind of diplomacy which a Belgian professor has called structural diplomacy, which the EU is very good at. It's a diplomacy that isn't just about relations, about foreign policy, but about a kind of diplomacy that concerns all level of the state, which one is with which one's having a relationship. And they showed, Bruno particularly, listing all the things that they do in that delegation, that the diplomatic output of the European External Action Service actually is far more than typical foreign policy. And that I think that was a useful lesson for everybody. And it shows really what I was trying to get at with this, that European diplomacy might be something different from what a state has typically done in the past. What we also saw with that is that the European External Action Service can do that kind of structural diplomacy, whereas all of our states are really too small to do it. They haven't got the resources, and they haven't got the whether it's personnel resources or financial resources, but Europe as a whole would have those kind of resources, and it's something where we will develop the idea of it being something qualitatively different from just national diplomacy. And I think Robert Cooper did, just to finish that point off, which is my last point, really. Remember he asked the question, what does the European External Action Service need to do now? And I think we've got, out of this day and a half, a kind of checklist, not just for the midterm review next year, but also an agenda, really, for thinking ourselves about individual bits of potential European diplomacy, and that's been very useful as well. So I've enjoyed it for all of those reasons, and I'm hoping that many of you go away with the same kind of thoughts in your mind, in particular in light of this last session now, which has given us the opportunity to think about values and the kind of values that we believe in and the kind of values that we would hope to transmit to others abroad. And it's one of those things where it's not about us winning some kind of ideological battle. It's not about our national interest or our interest in getting something from others, but actually transmitting something that might be of use to other people. And that's very worthwhile. So I think we all came into this room looking for different things with different levels of interest in the subject and different competence. And I think a lot of people came in, particularly the students that were here, with a fairly high level of confusion about what the European External Action Service actually was. My hope is that we leave the room with an even higher level of confusion, perhaps than when we came in, but more questions. And that's what this was about, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. So thank you very much to this last panel, and thanks to all the speakers.